the Triathlon Show 386. Hey, what's up, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Professor Bent Rennestad. Bent has been very influential in the sports science world, publishing lots of research in multiple areas, including concurrent training, high-intensity interval training, periodization, and heat training. And we will cover two of them in detail, interval training and heat training, and also go into a little bit of concurrent training at the end of this interview. But before that, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Form. The Form Smart Swim Goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training through a display on the goggle lens that shows you every split, a live stroke rate, live heart rate, your average pace for the interval, and all of the things that you need to be able to execute your swim workouts more optimally with better pacing and better control of your intensity. You also get access to in-depth post-swim analysis with additional metrics in the Form app, and this app syncs your workout seamlessly to platforms like Training Peaks, Strava, Today's Plan, and Final Surge. The app also has a vast library of workouts and training plans that you can sync with your goggles and be guided through them in your swimming, or you can build your own guided workouts. Get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's my interview with Professor Bent Rennestad. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Bent. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm fine. Thanks for having me here.
It's a great pleasure. Can you start by just introducing yourself to the audience? Tell us more about who you are.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor in exercise physiology at the Section for Health and Exercise Physiology at the Inland Norway University. And I'm also a consultant for a part-time consultant for the Norwegian Olympic Federation, providing physiological research and supervision for the Norwegian elite coaches and athletes in endurance sports. My research focus is primarily on the singular and combined effects of strength and endurance training in elite sport.
It's really interesting to hear you say that that's your primary research focus about concurrent training, strength and endurance training, because you've done so much. So I wasn't sure what you considered your primary focus. And I think that the first research from you that I read was the concurrent training research, but then there are a lot of interval training studies and heat training and even periodization, block periodization and things that you have done. So what would you say right now? Is it still the concurrent training that you have in the works the most, or do you keep your many irons in the fire, so to say?
That there are many different topics that I'm very interested in, and actually I started with actually pure strength training in the early beginning of 2000. But at the moment, I think both isolated endurance training and what we can call isolated strength training and the combination of them and how to best integrate those topics. I'm actually a bit confused myself if I need to point out something, because I'm interested in a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, the questions that we have prepared for today are actually not on that topic, because they are related to interval training and heat training, just because those were the two topics that at this moment I found the most interesting and intriguing for myself and for maybe for the listeners, that they will be the judge of that, I guess. But let's start with interval training.
you have done a lot of interval optimization studies to look at what intervals might be more or less effective for optimizing markers of performance and performance itself. And one thing to start with, in lots of studies, not just your studies, when people compare intervals, they often look at time near VO2 max as a marker of how effective an interval workout is. So often that is measured as how much time do you spend at 90% of VO2 max or higher. Can you discuss this? How much do we know about whether this is a really valid marker for the effectiveness of a workout?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because there is a lot of researchers and people, including myself, that focus, as you said, on time with high VO2 acutely during an interval session. And from my point of view, it started with a review paper from 1986, so long time ago, with Wenger and Bell, who discovered that the largest improvement in VO2 max was in the area of 90 to 100% of VO2 max as a training intensity. And from there on, there have been a lot of reviews on this topic, where this intensity has been theorized to be a very good intensity to train at in order to get adaptations. But very few people have actually investigated the training effects of accumulating a long high time around the VO2 max. So because it's very demanding to actually do that study, but it's very easy to do the acute ones and then just extrapolate. It's almost like all these acute signaling studies. And then on different molecular patterns or signal ways, and then you kind of extrapolate and think that these acute observations equals the long term adaptations, which I think is not so easy to do.
Yeah. So if I ask you in an applied sense, let's say you're consulting with some coaches or athletes, and you've seen some other research group somewhere in the world, they've done a new interval study investigating the acute responses to a new type of session, and they find that this session has a very high time near VO2 max at 90% or above. How confident would you be in saying that you should try this interval session, or would you want to wait and see actual performance and adaptation studies based on that session before really recommending it in an applied sense?
Yeah, well, I think it depends. The first I would do is actually to look at the protocol and see if that is reasonable and what's the idea behind accumulating a long time with high VO2. In order to maybe, okay, if this is a new approach that I haven't been thinking of, and this could be the mechanisms why this specific interval session gives a very good acute stimuli. It seems to be some good rationale behind it, and it also triggers some specifics that I want to achieve during that session, then I would be curious to test it out. But like for instance, If you have very short duration work periods, like 30 to 60 seconds, and then you have a long recovery period, and then you do this like some few repetitions, and the main aim of my session to my athlete is to accumulate a long time with high VO2, then I wouldn't go for that session, even though the data maybe supports it. But on the other hand, if the main aim of that interval session is to have a high power output and to stimulate that part of the performance spectra, then it could maybe make more sense in my head, and then I would maybe give it a shot.
And most people don't have a metabolic cart at home, so they can't really know how much time they spend near VO2 max. But one question on that is, how well does or does not heart rate correlate with time at VO2 max? So if you spend a lot of time at a very high heart rate versus a slightly lower heart rate for two different interval sessions, can you conclude anything from that, or is it tricky?
It's a bit tricky, and we have studies ourselves that indicates that the heart rate could be the same in two different interval sessions, but the mean VO2 is quite different. But of course, it is an indicator, so it's better than nothing. So in some cases, it can be used, but it's not the same as direct measuring VO2.
Yeah. No, that's a good piece of information to be aware of. You have, as we talked about, this researched a lot of different types of intervals. So, and this is actually something I watched quite recently, a talk that you did for the Japan High Performance Sports Symposium. I can't remember the exact name of it, but you went through a lot of the research that you have done. And four types of intervals that you can broadly categorize are short intervals, traditional long intervals, fast start long intervals, and variable long intervals. So can you maybe first just define and give examples of these types of intervals?
Yeah. So we have the traditional long intervals, which might be the easiest and the most common used among people. So, in my head, that's a kind of steady state, more or less work periods lasting like 4 to 6 minutes. And then you repeat them, from like 4 to 8 times or something like that. And then the three other types that we have looked into, they all include some kind of variation in the exercise intensity during either the work interval itself or in the work interval series. So, for instance, and in all those three alternatives, the high intensity could be at least a starting point. It could be the intensity that you have if you are working maximal for like 5 minutes, approximately. You have to find to tune it according to the individual athlete. But so the 13, 15 that we have done a lot on the short intervals. So there we have a series of work period of 30 seconds. Approximately at this intensity that I mentioned, and then 15 seconds recovery with around half of that exercise intensity. So, and then you continue for this like at least maybe 7-8 minutes, and then you have a break and you repeat it. And then the fast start long intervals is approximately the same intensity in the high intensity in the beginning, but then you reduce the intensity after like 1.5 or 2 minutes, and then you have the last like 3.5 to 3 minutes at an intensity slightly above threshold. And what is threshold? We could use many hours on that, let's keep it to this FTP or the maximal intensity that you can sustain for 1 hour approximately. So then you have like 1.5 to 2 minutes with a 5 minute intensity, and then you reduce it for the rest of that work period. And then the variable alternative is you can actually think that instead of starting with 2 minute high intensity, then you divide those 2 minutes into three different parts lasting 40 seconds and divide it throughout that 5 minute work interval. So we also often call it the 40-60. So 40 seconds at a higher intensity and then 60 seconds a bit above around threshold, and then we go up again for 40 seconds and down. Yeah, and if you do that three times, that will be a 5 minute work interval.
Yeah, and then so just to clarify one thing for the listeners is that when with those different variations of long intervals, you can at least in the research setting, what you do is basically make sure that the 5 minute periods are the same average power, but it's just how it's distributed, so that the you have the fast start with 2 minutes harder at the beginning, or you have the 2 minutes spread out in three different peaks, or you have the entire 5 minute segment, but that is a little bit higher because it doesn't go down as much as when you have the fast start or the variable. So, but the average power would be the same and the duration would be the same. So it's just how you distribute your power that varies. And then the 30-15, that's the short interval. So that's, of course, a bit of a different type. But in your research, what you've done is for three sets of 13 repetitions. So it ends up being basically 3 times 9.5 minutes or 9 minutes, 45 seconds with, I think you've used 3 minute recoveries between the sets. And there the intensity is very high in the 30 second. And then, but still not going crazy low in the 15 second, as you say, it ends up being still a kind of endurance power zone two. If you go down to 50% of your interval power, for example, a strong athlete might do 400 watts for the 30 seconds and 200 watts for the 15 seconds. So what tips can you give for how to execute these different types of intervals? So, and this might be, in some cases, maybe it's similar to what you've done in the research, but in some cases it might be different, for example, just following RPE-based instructions. What do you think is the best for athletes that want to try these intervals?
I think using RPE scale is sufficient and could give a very good session. And of course, heart rate is easy to access. So a combination of RPE and heart rate could be good ways of ensuring a good session. And from my point of view, I would recommend that first of all, you need a good warm-up, but let's say that is in place. And after a good warm-up, then I think you could be on the 6 to 20 RPE scale. You could be like on the 16 on the first interval. And then you could also be on 16 on the second, and then maybe start to touch upon the 17. But I don't think you need to go higher than the 17 actually to have a really good session. So it's not like all out. And then I think you should modify the workload or the work intensity based on your feelings, but acutely to try to achieve that feeling of and the description on the 17 is very hard, but it's not like extremely hard.
I'm just looking at your one of your papers with the long intervals and the short intervals to see. So you had you did various tests, of course, at the beginning of the study. But in terms of 20 minute power, I'm trying to find it here. For example, the short interval group. Well, both of the interval groups did around 345 watts average for 20 minutes. And then when we look at what they actually, the power they held for the intervals, so the 4x5 minute group did averaged 368 watts. So about 20 to 25 watts higher than their 20 minute power for the 5 minute intervals, 4x5 with 2.5 minutes rest. And then the short intervals, the 30-15s, they averaged 441 watts for the intervals. So obviously you can go harder there, but those are the high intervals. So that's just to give a bit of an idea to to listeners, but they can find the statistics in the paper as well, because I'll link to that in the show notes.
Just a brief comment to that, because in the experimental settings, just to make the condition similar, we instruct the cyclist to go all to give everything, so they should aim at as high mean power during each session as possible, and I don't think that's necessary to get a good training stimulus. So for the sustainability and the long term training, it's maybe not necessary to dig so deep.
Yeah. That's actually so follow up on that, because you've done some studies, at least case studies, with where you've done block periodization of intervals, where you do, for example, 5 interval sessions a week, and in those, I'm guessing that's the instruction that you've given when you do 5 interval sessions per week is what you said now to the listeners, that don't go absolutely all out, leave a little bit left in the tank. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, at the top of my head, there's some years since we did that. At least in the first studies, I think we actually instructed them to go to give everything. Mm. But in practical, when I'm talking to athletes and coaches, I'm actually not recommending that.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's good. Let me see here. So when we then look at the research around these different types of intervals, if we start with the acute responses and especially the time near VO2 max, how do they compare?
Yeah. So in general, those intervals with some variation in the exercise intensity seems to give a slightly longer time with high VO2. So that's the general point, I guess. And we have done most comparisons between the short intervals and the traditional long intervals, and also for the training adaptations. That's what we have actually investigated. And also in some acute intervals, it seems like maybe the short intervals could be slightly better than this fast start and with the variable intensities, but not a big, not a very big difference. So I think it's probably smart to have a variation around that topic. Yeah.
And what about the adaptations and performance improvements when you study that? What do you find?
Yeah, so it's when we compare the short intervals with the traditional long intervals, it seems to be larger adaptations using the short intervals in general on most measurements. And it must be emphasized that the two other approaches, we have not done any training interventions, so we haven't investigated those except for one week block, actually only in cross-country skiers, where the block group used this 40-60 approach, but that was not compared to another HIIT block, but just like a traditional training method. So we can't really tell upon the training adaptations for the variable and the fast start.
Okay. Yeah. So in terms of training adaptations, it's the comparisons you've done are the short intervals versus traditional long intervals.
Yeah.
And then when we're talking about here adaptations and performance improvements, and I guess performance marker improvements, we're talking about things like VO2 max improvements, 20 minute test improvements, watt peak, so the ramp test performance and power at 4 millimoles, those sorts of things. You've done that in several studies in several different demographics as well. So one of the more recent ones was in very well-trained cyclists that had VO2 maxes in the mid-70s, I think, 73, 74, 75. And you've also done it in well-trained cyclists. They were more in the 60s, I think. Is this something that I'm not aware, but have other research groups also been starting to study your these 30-15s? Because I think it's such an interesting interval type, and you've had so great results with them that it would make sense for others to also start to study them.
Yeah. At the top of my head, I'm not aware of any long-term interventions exactly using exactly that protocol, but at least on the acute stuff, there are some kind of similar approaches. And I mean, the short intervals, there are, of course, many are familiar with the kind of Tabatas approach, even though that's a bit different, at least if you look at the original protocols.
I'm just going to quantify a little bit. So in that most recent study where you had the elite cyclists with VO2 max of 73 on average, the differences that you found here, I'm reading from the abstract, where in terms of ramp test performance, so watt peak, 3.7% improvement for short intervals and minus 0.3 for long intervals. In terms of power at 4 millimoles, 2% improvement for short intervals, minus 2.8 for long intervals. And in terms of 20-minute power, 4.7% improvement for short intervals, minus 1.4% for long intervals. So just to give an idea of the, I guess the quantified effects, and I think in terms of overall effect size for performance, you found a small to moderate effect size there.
Yeah.
So going back to, in terms of actually using these intervals, you already said that you recommend using a variety. So can you talk more about that? How do you think it makes sense to add all of these in, and why?
Yeah. Of course it depends on what you want to emphasize. And I mean, like a typical argument for kind of not using short intervals is that, okay, when I'm going to compete, I will perform continuously for like, say 40 minutes. So short intervals is not a good idea or not a good training form because I will not have recoveries every 30 seconds. So, and of course, in terms of the specific muscle, how the muscle works, that's correct. But then when we see if you improve your power at 4 millimole and you increase your VO2 max, then in theory, at least, you should you have made the setting for a better improvement and performance for the 40-minute test, and that was actually what we saw as well. So you are able to improve kind of long-term high-intensity work by short intervals. That being said, I would also recommend to train on continuously working, since that's your specific competition setting. So, but say, if you want to emphasize, let's say for instance a mountain bike race where you have a or the situation where you have a fast start in the race, and that's actually important for your performance to get a good position and stuff like that, then these fast start approaches actually could be good in order to have many repetitions on and training on that specific ability. And then on the other hand, if you want to make it your strength to be able to accelerate, then this multiple peaks with variable exercise intensity could be a good choice. But then on the other hand, in a tempo time trial situation, then maybe just keeping a steady pace for a longer period could also be a good argument to use those intervals, the more traditional ones. So I think, and also I think that if you have done something for a long time, then the body naturally will respond better to a change, almost no matter what kind of changes, do some changes. And at least when there is not a big difference between all these workouts, then you have some good alternatives.
Yeah, no, those are all great points. And you have looked into, well, we mentioned a little bit the block periodization, and that's something that you've done some research in as well, how to structure when to do your intervals, or like, let's put it this way, whether it makes sense to do a lot of them and then few of them in maintenance mode, that sort of thing. Can you describe a little bit more these kind of periodization studies that you've done?
Yeah, so what we have done, we wanted to see if the distribution of the interval sessions made a difference. So say for a four-week period, the traditional approach could maybe be like two interval sessions per week for 4 weeks. And then we had this block approach. Maybe the first week had five interval sessions, and then we had one session every week for the three last weeks. So after 4 weeks, both groups had the same amount of interval sessions. It was only the organization of them that differed. And by using this approach in, what we can call well-trained cyclists, and also in cross-country skiers, it seems like you get maybe a slightly better adaptation by using this block approach, despite doing the exact same number of intervals from between pre and post testing.
Have you worked with triathletes, consulted with triathletes or triathlon coaches? Because that's one thing that that I think is always tricky for triathletes when you try to fit in three different sports. I can definitely see a cyclist doing five interval sessions per week, but for a triathlete, well, either you could do it in the different modalities, of course, but since you're also training, your volume is so high and you do three different sports, I find that the thought of that seems quite extreme. What are your thoughts for how, basically just a general thought on how to incorporate intervals as a triathlete versus a single sport athlete?
Yeah, it's definitely more challenging, as you said, for sure. From the top of my head, maybe one way of doing it, but I'm not sure if it's correct to do it, but if you want to do it, then you could yeah, like you say, emphasize one movement pattern, one of the three sports, and then you can have that. You could either focus on five intervals in that, cycling, and then you kind of have a maintenance stuff in swimming and running, or yeah, so that could be one way of doing it. But then the consequence of having a block like this is that you probably need to lower the total training volume during that period. Otherwise, I think you will get in trouble. So you must be aware of that. You need to give priority to the high intensity in that period if you're going to do it. But and another approach could be to mix the three sports in that HIIT block. But I'm not sure. And also, if you are doing like a 3 days cyclus with and then a recovery day on the fourth. I'm not quite sure how to do it, and as I understand it, there is also maybe you need to go a bit down on the intensity for the interval because you are doing so much.
Yeah. It's tricky. I don't have the answer either, but and of course it's very, that's it's yeah, that's why there are few studies in triathletes, because it's so difficult to control for these things. It's a lot easier when you just have cycling, especially. It's very easy to control for a lot of things. So it makes sense. But then as triathletes or triathlon coaches, we have to figure out how to apply it in the real world. And that's it becomes a lot of trial and error, basically. In terms of periodization, when do you think it makes sense in terms of the season to focus more on these intervals? And especially if you are, let's say, a road cyclist or a marathon runner or a triathlete where the races are quite long, so not a cross-country skier focusing on 10K or a skiathlon or sprint, but some longer events, basically, 2 hours and above.
Yeah. I think it depends, because you could argue that you could have a hit block actually early in the preparation period, in terms of if you want to emphasize this ability and get a lift on that. But then I'm completely aware of that. Some people think that it's dangerous to do high intensity so early in the preparation period, because then you get in shape, and shape can be dangerous. I don't know why, but some people say so. So it depends. You could take it early in the preparation period in order to get a lift in your performance, and then you go over to a more traditional approach with a high volume, and then you also make room for another block later in the preparatory period. Yeah, in my head, a block could be useful in those circumstances where you have been following another periodization approach for a long time, and you experience a plateau in your development, and then maybe a block could be something that make you take the next step. But I would not perform block all year long, because I think you should have a mix of different approaches, and as I mentioned earlier, a systematic variation, not only in the intervals that you are doing, but also in the periodization approach, is probably, yeah, I think it's smart.
For extremely long events like an Ironman, for example, I would say that the trend is that a lot of Ironman athletes are doing a lot of Ironman specific training, especially in the last 2 months, give or take, before a key race. And you don't tend to see that many athletes doing high intensity intervals in that specific period. Is that something that you would agree with, or do you think that there is a benefit? I'm not even talking about a block, but even just adding one interval or two interval sessions per week, even one might be like more than most people are doing. What do you think about that specificity versus the benefits of intervals in the final preparation period?
Yeah, I think it would be exciting to test it out. To have some intensity, at least if we are, of course it's cost benefit, but if you are thinking about the signaling and the effect of the high intensity, it's kind of likely that it would also affect the threshold work and your capacity at threshold. And so I have some experience with pretty well athlete performing both high intensity work and actually also blocks of high intensity before stage races. It's not like an extreme triathlon competition, but at least there is like from 4 to 6 hours stages every day for many days in a row, and it seems like there could be some advantages, but of course we are all different, so as always, do not test it out just before the most important race of your year. If you are curious on it. Yeah,
yeah. Makes sense. Is there anything else that we should talk about regarding interval training?
But just as we mentioned now, the individuality and the differences in response, and be aware of that. So don't copy what other people do blindly, at least. I want to encourage testing out, but do some measurements or something so you can actually evaluate the effect on yourself or the people. The people you are coaching. So there are individual differences, and there are a lot of different intervals and training methods that work. So it's not like one type of training is the correct.
Yep.
Be curious. Yeah.
That's a great point to end the interval section on and move on to heat training. And this is a topic that I was really excited to chat about because I think what you've done is done some really interesting research that is actually applicable to the everyday athlete more so than most previous research, because you have, not moved away from the heat chamber, but found an alternative method that can be used without a heat chamber, basically using a heat suit that people can put together themselves quite easily and not very expensively. But before we get into the specific protocols that you've used and all that, can you give an overview of why heat training is an interesting area to explore for endurance athletes?
Yeah. So firstly, my impression is that it seems like more and more important competitions are performed in a kind of warm or hot climate. So for acclimatization purpose, to get used to the heat when you are competing, that's one pretty obvious aspect. And then we have our findings indicating that heat training also can increase hemoglobin mass, in theory is an advantage for endurance performance. And this effect on hemoglobin mass seems to be kind of similar to what has been observed after altitude training. And then it's much cheaper to do the heat training, especially during the past years with the COVID pandemic and the restriction to travel, you can do it all over the world actually, where you are home, this heat training. So a simple and low cost alternative to altitude training.
Mm. What kind of performance improvement have been observed in temperate conditions after a block of heat training?
Yeah, so the findings are more clear towards the hemoglobin mass than actually performance. Mm. But then we know that there are many factors affecting performance. So in some of our studies, we see an increased power output at 4 millimole, and also some indications on what we can call time trials, like 15 minute mean power output, maximal power output, and. So there are some indications that it improves performance, but not all our studies and the studies of others. All are not showing performance improvement.
Which is probably similar to altitude, right? Because not all of altitude studies show that, and even anecdotally, not everybody experiences improvements after going to altitude. But also some people say that, and what you see with a lot of the best athletes is that they have gone to altitude many times a year for many, many years. And then it's kind of almost like it seems like there could be an accumulative effect of multiple exposures to altitude. And then over time, you also get that performance improvement. Because that's one of the things that's interesting about altitude is that, and that you have in one of your papers, you discussed that the effects are pretty short-lived and hard to maintain, so you have to really time it correctly. But then at the same time, there are so many case studies of athletes that they go to altitude for 4 weeks in the winter and then 4 weeks in the spring and then 4 weeks before a major competition in the late summer. So are those winter and spring exposures to altitude completely wasted? I don't know. It's hard to study, but you would guess that since a lot of the best athletes are doing it, probably not completely wasted, and there might be some cumulative effect, and maybe the same could be said for heat training if you repeat blocks of it, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the science is clear on the repeated effects of altitude camps, but nevertheless, they are a way on a training camp focusing solely on training and recovery for like three four weeks. So they anyway get a good high training quality, and usually that's a good preparation for, if you're talking about cyclist stuff, for the spring classics. And then they go again at altitude to have a new good training period and maybe reboost the hemoglobin mass and performance before the kind of summer races. So at least those benefits are there for sure. But accumulating hemoglobin mass, I'm not sure.
It was very speculative, of course.
Yeah. but regarding if it could have the same reasoning for heat training, I don't know. I'm working closely with some cyclists that have used heat training for a long period of time, and we have published some cases on this, and it seems like there are potential to accumulate and also maintain increased hemoglobin mass with this heat training over a prolonged period, and also because the initial protocol is for 5 weeks, five heat sessions per week, and then if we reduce it to three sessions per week for 3 week period, we see that maintains the hemoglobin mass, and after 3 weeks after altitude stay, great majority of studies shows that you are back to base level in terms of hemoglobin mass. So there are some possibilities, at least.
Yeah. One thing we should say, perhaps just to make sure everybody is clear on that, is hemoglobin mass is one factor that affects VO2 max. So in theory, if you improve your hemoglobin mass, increase it, then you could improve your VO2 max. Although in some studies, you have seen an increase in hemoglobin mass without seeing an improvement in VO2 max. So it's not always a clear-cut relationship there, but at least it gives the potential for improving VO2 max. Let's continue with the protocols. So in more detail, so you said 5 weeks, five sessions per week, and what are those sessions like?
Yeah. So in terms of power output, I think this session should be as easy as possible, achieve the correct heat stimuli. They are cycling for 50 minutes and with a power output more or less half of that 4 millimole power, and maybe less as well. So low power. And then we have this heat suit. The way we organized it was that they had a wool layer on both the upper and lower body and a wool hat. And then we had a rain jacket and trouser on, and then a down jacket outside this rain jacket. So in terms of keeping increasing the heat within the body.
That's a lot of clothes. I found a photo on Google of what it looks like, and they are very well dressed for an indoor training session. so you have the you described the heat suit, and I guess you're not using any fans when doing these sessions. And but the temperature in the room is it a normal room temperature, or do you try to heat it up?
Yeah, the way we did it was just a normal temperature of the room, which was 17, 18 degrees, and there is a big difference if the room temperature increases by only 2-3 degrees, you will notice that a lot. So then you either need to reduce the clothes or reduce the power output.
Yeah. So what are the instructions in terms of how to execute it? Are they executed based on power or based on RPE, heart rate, or even core temperature?
Yeah, a combination, I would say. The main measurement that we care about is the rectal temperature that we want to be at 38.5 degrees. So that's the main measurement. And we are just measuring that immediately after the session. So for the first time, it's a bit trial and error. So usually people are going too high in their first session, ending up around 39, and that's not a very good experience. So then they need to either reduce the power output or the amount of clouds. And also we want a bit dehydration during that session. We think that's important, but we don't know. So they are advised to drink like half a liter of water during the session, and then they will typically lose or the body weight will be like from 1 to 2 kilo lighter after the session. So they are a bit dehydrated, but of course this depends on the body size of the person. And then it's very important to rehydrate well after the session.
Mm. And what would you say? Well, actually, this maybe gets into one of the later questions already, but do you think that the evidence is strong enough that is this something you recommend when consulting with athletes and coaches? And if you do, and they don't have access to actually measuring the rectal temperature, how do you recommend that they execute it in an applied setting?
Yeah, well, to measure the rectal temperature is quite easy, just to have the normal device for it and just check after immediately after the session. Yeah.
Okay.
So I would recommend to use that actually. So whether I would recommend or not, it depends. Some athletes think these heat sessions are horrible. And I really struggling to do it, and I don't want to do it. And in that case, I would not recommend it. If they are using a lot of energy on these sessions, I think we have now like 5 studies showing an improved hemoglobin mass, and probably our way of measuring hemoglobin mass is more accurate than our way of measuring performance. So it's probably easier and less noise in the hemoglobin mass measurements compared to the performance measurements. But still, there is not I think you should have optimized your training quality and your organization of your training, because before you start with this heat training, the improvement possibilities are not that big, but they are there. So if you are really at your limits, then it could make a difference. But if you have a long way to go with your training and your training quality and stuff like that, I would prioritize that.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense. But what if your goal race is a really hot race, like let's say you're going to the Ironman World Championships in Kona, would your recommendation change then, and it would be a more important consideration?
Yeah, for sure. Then it's no issues. If you're going to compete in a hot climate and you are not used to that, that will save you a lot of power. So or gives you a lot of power. So for sure, no doubt about that. And then it will be like say that 10 days heat training before the main race.
Okay, so you wouldn't do you wouldn't go all the way to five. I guess the mechanisms you're looking for are different. It's more about plasma volume and even just the thermal sensation rather than focusing on hemoglobin mass, and you can get those other adaptations more quickly. Is that the reason for only 10
minutes? Yeah, and the sweat rate and stuff like that.
Got it. It's interesting though that you say that some athletes find the sessions horrible, because you have I'll link to some of the papers, but at least one of them that I have in front of me, the RPE that the athletes rated these sessions at wasn't super high. Also, the heart rate wasn't super high. Of course, it's a bit elevated, but it didn't, just from reading the table with how the athletes, the data from the sessions, it didn't seem so hard. But is it just the sensation, the thermal sensation for some athletes is just completely out of alignment with, for example, heart rate, or how does it work?
Yeah, it is. And also it's, I got the impression that also it's the logistics demand around it, because you then have your afternoon heat session and everything gets entirely wet, and you need to wash your clothes, and you need to dry up the floor, and you need to do all this extra stuff in addition to your normal training routines, and doing that five times a week for some people, that's it's not so funny. But then we have other people who really see the and feel the benefit of it, and who I have one who have almost done this continuously for 2 years now. so he is really addicted to it.
Yeah. And can you do that when you do that the five sessions a week, 50 minutes, is the rest of your training, can it be normal? Can you maintain your normal volume and normal intensity, or do you decrease any of that?
Yeah, more or less normal, but at least the first week, when you're starting with heat training sessions, I recommend to take down the overall volume and maybe also intensity, just to make that an easy training week. Because the first 2, 3, 4 sessions feels more heavy than the rest.
Yeah. And I think we should mention, because we didn't really mention it properly, at least, that in these heat suit studies that you've done, you've also had a heat chamber group. So you have compared them and found that the heat suit was as effective, or was it even more effective in some variables. But that's a really important finding, I think.
Yeah. So it seems like you can achieve the same as a heat chamber by the doing this heat suit training, and of course it's much easier to do a heat, to put on a heat suit, or to overdress.
yeah. Even though definitely can't be in that group that would think that the cleaning up after a session would be horrible, and probably make me not be so inclined to do that type of protocol unless I felt like I really needed it. What about passive heat training? It's not, or so saunas and things like that. How does these kinds of active protocols compare with passive protocols?
We haven't compared them directly ourselves, but in general, my impression of the literature is that it's slightly better to have active during the heat stimuli. In one of our studies, for a 10-day study, just for the heat acclimatization stuff, we had one group performing this heat training that we are discussing now, and then they added a passive heat bath in addition on the daily basis. So it was two daily heat stimulus, and then we add, and we didn't see any extra benefits of adding a extra passive heat bath, but that's a bit different setting that what you asked for. So yeah. In general, I would recommend being active during the heat stimuli.
Mm. Would the passive is there anybody that would for whom that would be a good option? And is it more for let's say performance in hot conditions, or is that also when it's been researched, has it also been researched in terms of improving performance in temperate conditions and potentially improving hemoglobin mass and so on?
At the moment, I'm not aware of studies investigating this on hemoglobin mass, but maybe you know of some.
No, I don't. No. But yeah, I think my feeling is the same as yours, but I'm not as familiar with it, of course, but that's kind of the feeling that I have. But yeah, I think in terms of heat training, is there anything, well, let's say one more question then. If you are somebody that you have a relatively optimized training process and you're looking for that final percent maybe, and you're thinking about giving heat training a go, and it's not something that you've tried a session and it's not terrible for you, how would you then implement it in terms of periodization?
Yeah, so I would start with it in a period where you don't have any important races, preferably during the preparatory period, and then I would give it a 5-week period with 5 sessions per week, and from there on, and I would recommend to be finished with this 5-week period before the important races, so you can go over in a maintenance phase of the heat stimuli and prioritize the what you can call performance peaking approaches, or what prepare you best for the important races during the final weeks. And typically we recommend to do these heat sessions in the afternoon as a second session. You could do it before ordinary session, or you can do it directly after an ordinary session, but then if you're doing it after, it feels more heavier compared to have a break, some hours in between. And before, it will of course fatigue you for that final part of that, or main part of the session.
Yeah. Is there anything else about heat training that we should mention?
No, I think you should be aware that from my point of view, I don't think it's like the hotter, the better effect. It's many athletes thinks that, okay, if heat stimuli is good, then I would be as hot as possible to get the rectal temperature as high as possible. I don't think we have evidence for say that. And in addition, that could be potential dangerous. So avoid being too overheated.
Yeah. One question on that, actually, with the rectal temperature measurement is, of course, I'm sure you're aware about the core body temperature sensor. Is that something that you have? I know you haven't used it in the studies, but have you used it in the field, or do you have any experience with it?
Yeah, and that could be a good alternative for sure. What we have used is that we have in the beginning compared it with the rectal temperature, so we know the ratio. Probably there are some individual differences in how the heat is transmitted to the sensor. So it's if it's important to be precise, I would recommend to compare the sensor measurements with rectal measurements in the beginning to know the ratio there, more or less.
Yeah, makes sense. All right. Well, since we have a bit of time still, so I'm just going to ask you about the concurrent training. If you can give an overview of the state of evidence currently with concurrent training and your practical recommendations for how to implement concurrent training for endurance athletes.
Yeah, so it depends on the sport. And of course, the athlete and the coach must think this is a good idea. Otherwise, you can just skip it. But if they think it's a good idea and they want to do it the proper way, then like for a runner, if you are thinking running, it seems like it doesn't matter if you are doing load, high effort or high intensity exercises, like the plyometric or what we can call explosive strength training, seems to give the same benefits as heavy strength training, traditional heavy strength training with like 5 to 10 repetition maximum. So for runners, it seems like you can do the type of those two. You can do the choice you prefer. And for cyclists, it still seems to be a advantage of heavy strength training, performing heavy lifts in terms of performance benefits. In running, it seems like the mechanisms is going by improving the running economy and thereby improving performance. And for cycling, it's actually not that clear evidence for improving work economy, but it depends on how you are measuring it. And in our lab, we have some protocols where we are measuring cycling economy both in the fresh and the more fatigued state, and it seems more clear in the more fatigued state. But in performance wise, in different time trials and stuff like that, it seems like also for cycling to be a good evidence for that heavy strength training can improve cycling performance.
Yeah. And how often and for how long would you do strength training to get these effects?
I would recommend a minimum of 8 weeks, but preferably longer. And then my standard recommendation is 2 sessions per week.
And within those sessions, you would have 3 to 4 exercises, or how many exercises?
Yeah, 3 to 4 on the main muscle groups.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And with the heavy strength for cycling, you said 5 to 10 repetition maximum. So that's actually a bit higher than I thought you would say. So is that something that has changed a little bit, or what is the reason for that?
No, we have used that range more or less in all our studies, and the reason is that actually that I think there are some evidence that doing high reps in order to actually get some muscle growth is beneficial. Also, when we express power per kilo body mass, so typically what we do is, in the beginning or in the preparatory period, that's when we have the largest repetition numbers. And also a slight change from session to session within the week. So say for the first 3-4 weeks, you have 8 reps one day and 10 reps the other day. And then you do that for 4 weeks, and then you can reduce it slightly. So for the next 4 weeks, you have like 5 and 8 or 5 or 7. And then for the last 3-4 weeks period, you reduce it a little more. And then thereafter, you can go over in like a maintenance phase with like 1 session per week or 1 session per 10th day or something like that.
Yeah. And would you do 2 or 3 sets of each exercise?
Yeah, typically 3 sets.
Mm-hmm. And how close to maximum should you lift?
pretty close when we're talking heavy strength. So like 2-3 reps in reserve, maybe 4, but yeah, but pretty heavy.
Right.
And it also depends if it's an endurance athlete with no experience in strength training at all, then I just say no reps in reserve, because they have so much more inside than they think. So if you say no reserves, then maybe there actually will be 2-3 in reserve.
Yeah. That's a good point. But I guess one thing that I'm thinking is that it also depends a little bit. If they have no experience, then you want to be careful with the injury risk. And so that's another factor to consider.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, you need to ensure that the lifting technique is correct. But as long as that is correct, I'm not that afraid of loading them.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. Yeah, was there anything other on concurrent training that I wanted to ask? Rest between sets. How long would that be?
Yeah, typically 2 minutes. I think there is a big range of what you can do, and it really doesn't matter that much.
Yeah. Yeah. One other question that I was thinking of: unilateral versus bilateral, or a mix of both.
Yeah. So in most sports, we are using one limb at a time. So in terms of specificity and also there are studies indicating that if you are lifting with only one leg, for instance, you are able, and we multiply that with two, we are able to lift more load than if you use both legs. So there are some theory, at least, why it could be beneficial to use one leg at a time during the strength training. And also, if you are thinking like squats, one-leg squats and stuff like that, you also, the advantage is that you have less load on your body. So you can argue that you are reducing the risk of injury a little bit, at least if you get if you're losing your balance and you are going to fall. So it's okay to have a mix, but I would recommend to have at least some exercises with one limb at a time.
Yeah, because I think that most of the literature is still with mostly bilateral, so classic squats and deadlifts and things. So is that a correct assessment of it?
Yeah, I think so. We have usually used one leg press, and also we used for the squat. I would like to recommend to do it in a Smith machine, and then it's very easy to do it with one leg at a time.
Yeah.
There are many studies also using both legs at the same time. But for running, it's easy to be very specific, at least in the explosive or explosive jump exercises, which can imitate the running stride very precisely.
Yeah. So final question on strength training then. Off the top of your head, if you're consulting with a triathlete, but we're focusing on the bike and the run here, 4 or 5 exercises that they should have in their repertoire, which ones would you choose?
Yeah. So I would have the one-legged leg press, and I would have one-legged squats, like lunges or something, preferably actually in a Smith machine, so you can really load the thigh, the glutes, and then maybe like toe raises, and for the last one, it could actually be. It depends. Maybe you should do some explosive jumps and imitating the running pattern with like what you can call one foot at a time, and try to come as far that it will be like the horizontal jumps. Mm. come as far as possible in, like, if you're doing it every second leg, then it will be five jumps on each leg, for instance, something like that. So that could be like four exercises.
Yeah, sounds good. General question, if you could give three pieces of advice to amateur athletes that are listening to this interview, what would that be? Advice about anything, not just these topics, or it doesn't have to be these topics that we have discussed today.
Okay, so number one, choose training sessions that are sustainable and as enjoyable as possible. And then the second could be to try to have a purpose for your training sessions and design the sessions according to your purpose. And then try to challenge your training habits, because usually we are falling into these patterns that we just repeat and repeat and repeat. So try to challenge your training habits and make some changes every third or fourth month.
Yeah, that final piece is very, I think it's a very good thing. The two others, of course, are also very, very good, but they have been said a lot of times in different ways. But the third one, I think, yeah, it's not something that we always think about. But yeah, I like that. It's a very good piece of advice. And then the rapid fire questions. What's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
Yeah, I will be very boring that there and just say PubMed.
Yeah, you're not the first person to do that. What's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Yeah, well, I don't know, but maybe focusing on the possibilities that occur when things are not going as planned, because it usually is not going as planned. So then try to look on possibilities that gives you.
Yeah. And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
Well, my mentors who kick-started my way into exercise physiology, and then now my wife, Guru.
Great. Thank you so much, Bent. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. And where can listeners follow you? I know you have a lot of your research on ResearchGate, but I don't think you're on Twitter or anything like that. So is ResearchGate the best place?
Yeah, correct. I'm not so good on social media, so ResearchGate is perfect.
It's good for you. Sometimes I take a few weeks off Twitter and I notice my productivity really goes up. So <Yeah. laughs> should do it more often. All right. Well, thank you again. It was great to chat to you. Hope to do it again another time.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and I will have plenty of links there to many of the papers on the topics that we discussed here. So primarily interval training and heat training, but also I will add a relatively recent systematic review on concurrent training in there that you can check out. Next Monday, I interview Matt Pendula, who is a strength training expert for running and triathlon performance, who has worked with athletes like Ben Canute and Gwen Jorgensen. If you want to improve your triathlon performance and want help to achieve your goals, consider working with a scientific triathlon coach or training plan. We have options for athletes of different levels, different budgets, and no matter the size of your goals. A few points that I want to mention that help reduce the barrier to get started is that we have no minimum commitment term nor startup fees for coaching. And for training plans, we have a 100% satisfaction guarantee for plans purchased on our website and an exchange guarantee, so you can exchange your plan for another plan if you purchase through Training Peaks. We also have consultation and customized plan options that you can check out. Find out more and contact us on scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss your specific goals and needs and see what's best for you. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS23 at checkout for 15% off your first order. And thank you to Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. Use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.